It seemed like that was all just given.
You gotta come up to the flight deck,
the dark-skinned man said. Alex, Holden had called him.
We gotta get out of here, but I'm not letting either of you two sons of bitches out of my sight.
Teresa followed them, unsure what else to do. Amos walked with her through the sideways lift and flight deck. A beautiful older woman with curly white hair pulled down almost over her eyes was waiting there. When she saw Holden, she took a long, shuddering breath. The prisoner took her hand.
All right, Alex said. Everybody strap in. We're off this mud ball.
A rough cheer rose all around her, and Teresa surprised herself by joining in. Amos took her by the shoulder and led her to an ancient-looking, thoroughly disreputable crash couch.
You're gonna need to strap in, Tiny. I got an idea what to do with this one, he said, pointing a thick thumb at Muskrat. So you just stay here with Naomi and the captain.
Naomi, Teresa said. That's Naomi Nagata?
And this is the Rocinante, Amos said. And I don't know who most of the rest of these people are, but one way or another, we're home.
And then he was gone, leading Muskrat into the belly of the ship and leaving her to stare up into the monitor. It felt strange, like she was in a dream, but also mundane as walking down a slightly unfamiliar hallway. She was here. She was leaving. The ship shuddered, hissed, started to rise up.
You want me to kick on the main drive?
Alex asked over the sound of the thrusters burning.
I could slag that whole palace if you want.
No, Holden said. Leave it be. We still have friends there. Elvie, for one.
Oh, Alex said. Should we go get her?
No, Holden said. She's where she needs to be.
The Rocinante rose, pushing Teresa back into the cool blue gel of the couch. The ship shuddered and hummed as it rose, and then when they were high enough from the ground, a new, deeper thrum began, and they leaped upward. Into the darkness of space, leaving everything behind. She closed her eyes, trying to decide what she felt. If she felt anything, or maybe everything all at once. Her home, everything she'd ever known, was falling away behind her, and all she was certain of was that she never wanted to go back. The princess was getting hell and gone from fairyland. A sharp alert caught her attention at the same moment the pilot, Alex, said something obscene. She looked over at him, and his face was ashen.
Alex? The woman said.
We've been target-locked, Alex said. We took too long. It's the whirlwind.
Chapter 49. Naomi. Because the Rocinante was built to land on its belly, Holden stepped onto the flight deck wall. He looked thin. More than thin, he looked like he'd been ill for months. The lines around his mouth were deeper than they'd been, and his grin looked less like his usual easy joy and more like surprise that anything good had actually happened. He looked bruised at heart, but only that, not broken. He didn't look broken. He met her eyes, and something in her chest that she didn't know could relax, relaxed. She took a long, shuddering breath. Jim took her hand. She'd thought that would never happen again, and here he was, touching her again.
Hey, he said, too softly for anyone to hear but her.
Hey, she said back. Amos behind him looked wrong. His skin was gray, and his eyes were a uniform black. She'd seen kids on Pallas affect the same look with dyes and scleral tattooing, but on Amos it didn't look like an edgy fashion choice. Also, he was carrying a big black dog with a gray muzzle and a perplexed expression. The girl beside him seemed familiar, but not so much that Naomi could place her. There would be time for stories later. Alex climbed up to his crash couch, grinning.
All right, everybody strap in. We're off this mud ball.
The crew cheered, not quite drunk with success, but maybe a little tipsy. Or maybe that was just her. Holden slipped into one of the other couches, staying close to the girl, protective of her. Slowly, the ship tilted back to its normal upright position.
You want me to kick on the main drive? Alex asked. I could slag that whole palace if you want.
Before Naomi could answer, Holden did.
No, leave it be. We still have friends there. Elvie, for one. Oh, should we go get her?
Holden shook his head, even though Alex wasn't looking at him.
No, she's where she needs to be.
He'd been on the ship for less than 15 minutes, and he was answering like he was the captain. If she'd pointed it out, he would have been horrified and apologetic, and maybe in some other context she would have expected the apology. She was, after all, the head of the underground, the engineer behind the campaign, and 100 other operations besides. The pleasure of having him back, of feeling herself and Alex and the ship falling into ancient patterns, was more than she could express. It was like waking up after a long and terrible dream to find that whatever it was hadn't actually happened. In all her long life, it was maybe the most beautiful moment she'd ever had. It couldn't last. She felt Alex flying the ship inside Laconia's atmosphere, sliding them above the landscape and rising up above it until the drive plume wouldn't be a danger to anyone below. When the main drive kicked on, they shot up, rising through the last of the atmosphere and into the light of the Laconian sun. As Alex laid in their course for the ring gate, Naomi checked the tactical map for her fleet. The burns they were all under were punishing. By keeping on the edge of what human endurance would allow, they made it less likely that the Laconian ships would reach them, and the enemy ships themselves. She pulled up an overlay that showed the destroyers and the Magnetar-class battleship. It was like looking over and finding a centipede on her arm. The target lock alert came on, cutting through the merriment and joy like a scalpel.
Alex? We've been target locked. We took too long. It's the whirlwind.
Naomi laid down a sensor feed over her tactical display. The Magnetar was still almost nothing without magnification, hardly more than a pale spot of darkness in the middle of the steady star that was its drive plume. With only a little magnification, though, it was the same eerie, almost organic shape as the Tempest, the bone-pale vertebra of an unimaginably huge animal. A ship like that had brought two navies to their knees. A single frigate, with its supplies nearly drained, already didn't stand a chance. All her joy collapsed to ashes. She wondered whether Duarte would let her see Jim when they were both in prison, whether they'd even be allowed the option of surrender. Fighting down through the planetary defenses had taken 4 ships and cost 1 of them. Or, depending on the next few minutes, maybe 2. At least the Whirlwind was the last Magnetar that would ever be built. She'd broken the construction platforms, so at least that. If she died in the effort, if they all did, Bobby would still have approved. Some sacrifices were worth it.
We have a tight beam request incoming from the Whirlwind, Ian said. His voice only shook a little.
Let's have it, Naomi said, and Ian looked at her. The uncertainty in his eyes was clear. He didn't know if she was going to surrender or lead them all into death. She wasn't perfectly certain herself.
Now, Kafilwe, this won't get better by waiting.
He put the incoming message on every display, though only Naomi's was live. She didn't know if he meant to pressure her by letting the whole crew see the exchange, or if he was nervous and screwed up. It didn't make a difference. The woman on her screen was young, with dark skin and straight, close-cropped hair. She wore Laconian blue, and the rank insignia of an admiral, the same style that Mars used to use. The rage in her eyes gave Naomi very little hope.
I am Admiral Sandrine Gujarat, commander of the Laconian battleship Voice of the Whirlwind. You have 30 seconds to drop core, deactivate your weapon systems, and open your airlock for boarding. Failure to do exactly as you are told will result in the destruction of your ship.
30 seconds. Naomi raised her chin in defiance. If she was taken, they would get everything she knew eventually. The networks and contacts in dozens of systems. The long-term plans and strategies. Everything she'd built in all the time she'd spent working for Saba and then taking his place. It had made her into a perfect asset for the enemy. A ship full of her people stood breathless, waiting for her to decide whether to give them all over or let them all die. It was like being crushed under 100 G's and weightless at the same time. The voice that answered wasn't hers. It wasn't even one she knew.
No, Admiral Gujarat. It will not end in anybody's destruction. You will stand down at once.
On her screen, the admiral's eyes widened in anger, but also in confusion. Naomi craned her neck to see the girl who had spoken. She was in a crash couch, gesturing that the comms control should be transferred to her. Naomi hesitated for a moment, then went with it. When the Rossi's feed showed the girl's face, the Laconian admiral paled.
Do you know who I am, Admiral?
I don't...
The High Consul?
Yes, I am the High Consul's daughter and heir, the girl said.
You understand now.
Good. I am on the Rocinante at my father's request. Your threat is ridiculous, and your orders are to return immediately to your assigned mission protecting the home world.
The girl couldn't be 16 yet, but her voice had an easy arrogance. Naomi turned to Jim and mouthed, "Is that true?" He lifted his hands in a belter's shrug.
"Miss," the admiral said, unconsciously bowing as she did, "you are... I was unaware. This is very irregular, miss. I'm afraid I can't allow this ship to go anywhere."
The girl rolled her eyes dramatically.
"Is there a protocol? A security protocol?
I'm sorry?
If I am in distress, being held against my will, threatened, whatever, is there a phrase I use to indicate that? Something innocuous I can slip into any conversation without my captors knowing it?
It's a yes or no question, Admiral. This isn't hard."
At this rate, the Whirlwind was going to nuke them to be rid of the girl.
"There is, miss," Admiral Gujarat said. "And have I said it?"
"You haven't."
"Then we can take it as a given that I am not here under duress. That something is going on between the High Consul and the leadership of the Underground, something with which I have been entrusted, and you haven't. With that in mind, go back to your post."
The woman on the screen squared her shoulders.
"I have orders from Admiral Trejo that..."
"Stop," the girl said.
"What's his name?"
"Whose?"
"Admiral Anton Trejo. What is his last name?"
"Trejo?"
"Yes," the girl said,
and leaned close to the camera so that her whole face filled the screen. She spoke softly and with an incandescent rage.
"Mine is Duarte."
"I'm sorry, miss," the admiral said. "I can't let your ship leave."
"No,"
the girl said.
"Then shoot me the fuck down."
She dropped the connection and turned to Alex, staring down at her slack-jawed.
"We can go. That woman is scared to death right now."
"Prepare for high burn,"
Alex announced over the ship-wide channel, and the girl nodded curtly and settled back in her couch.
"Jim?" Naomi said.
"I know," he said. "It's been a really weird day."
"We thought you were dead," Naomi said as she stepped into the lift.
Amos blinked his unnerving black eyes, then shrugged.
Yeah, I can see that, boss. What can I tell you?
Sorry. 8 hours of high burn had taken them out of the whirlwind's effective range. 15 had increased the distance to the point that she almost felt safe. Not safe, but close enough that she could imagine stepping away from the ops deck and starting to make sense of everything that had happened, hearing everything that had brought Jim and Amos back, and how Teresa Duarte fit into it. And also to tell them what had happened during their long and separate pilgrimages, what they had lost. With the four of them together, Alex had asked for the ceremony, as if the universe had given them a chance, and he was worried that if he didn't take it now, it would somehow slip away. And she and Amos were heading to the airlock together again, as if the past had returned, but as if it had returned changed. The changes to Amos were odd. His skin was somehow pale and dark at the same time, like a thin coat of white paint over black. His eyes were darkness, and there was something strange about the way he moved. But after so long, being able to think of him without grief and worry made the alterations only interesting. It was so much better than what she'd already carried with him, with losing him.
I'd have called earlier, but, well, I wasn't ready to go. I was being patient.
What happened? He shrugged.
One thing and another. Good to be back, though.
The lift stopped and she stepped off. Amos followed just a step behind. You're different.
Yep, he said, smiling amiably.
It was such an unmistakably Amos-like thing to say. Such a familiar way to say it. Did the bomb fail? She asked.
Nope, it was fine.
So why didn't you follow through on the mission? No blame, but what was your thinking there? Amos went still for a moment, like he was listening to something she couldn't hear.
I met the kid, Amos said. Seemed kind of shitty killing her. I thought maybe it was the wrong call.
He shrugged. Naomi stepped over and put her arms around him. It was like hugging a metal strut. Good to have you back. Alex and Holden were at the interior door to the airlock. Alex had changed into an MCRN uniform, an artifact from another age. Jim was in a white, formal shirt. He'd washed his hair and combed it back. He looked distinguished and somber. The coffin in the airlock was just a shell, hardly more than a body bag with slightly hardened sides, and it was empty.
This is the way we always did it, Alex said now that they were together. When we lost someone and couldn't recover the body, we'd still take the moment.
He cast his eyes to the deck. Jim did the same. Amos put on the same somber face he always did at moments like this. A flood of complex feelings washed through her. Sorrow and joy, relief and the emptiness of a loss that would never be made whole. Alex cleared his throat and wiped his eyes with the back of his hand.
Bobby Draper was one of my best friends. She was a Marine right down to her bones. Anything else she did was built on that. She was brave and honorable. And she was strong. She made a hell of a captain. I remember when Fred Johnson tried to make her into an ambassador back in the day, and she kept calling it the way she saw it instead of playing politician. She was always like that. She took on the impossible, and she made it work.
He took a deep breath, opened his mouth like he was going to go on, then closed it again and shook his head. Jim was weeping now, too, and so was she. Amos's newly black eyes shifted like he was reading something in the air, and he lifted his chin.
She was a badass, he said,
then paused and nodded, satisfied. She will be missed, Naomi said, from now on and forever. They stood in silence for a moment, and then Jim stepped forward and cycled the exterior door. When it was open, the little chemical boosters on the coffin slid it to the edge of the lock, and then it was gone. Jim cycled the lock closed again, turned and stepped in, putting his arms around her and Alex. A moment later, the solid mass of Amos's arms looped around her, too. The four of them held each other there, with the hum and rumble of the Rocinante around them. They stayed there for a long time. The elements of her little ragtag fleet that had been closest to the ring gate were through long before the Rossi was even halfway through the system. Alex kept them at a punishing burn, balancing the reaction mass they still had and the distance to a friendly resupply depot in Gossner system. If they took breaks a little more often than during the dive into the system and burned a little less heavily, it was to conserve mass, and because the Whirlwind and her cohort of destroyers were parked close in to Laconia, still knocking down the torpedoes and long-arc rocks that Naomi's people had flung at the planet. 3 days into their burn toward the gate, someone somewhere had grown the balls to issue an order, and the Whirlwind flung half a dozen torpedoes at the retreating Rossi. The PDCs took them all down, and no more followed. When they were burning, Naomi used the time to calculate a safe transit schedule and tight-beam it to the other ships. From the start of the campaign to its end, they'd lost 32 ships, and just shy of 200 lives. They had retrieved Jim and Amos, taken in Teresa Duarte, and destroyed the mechanism of production that Laconia depended on for its high-powered fleet. The Whirlwind was still a massive killing machine capable of taking control of any system it chose, but it was only one ship. It couldn't attack through any of the ring gates without leaving Laconia unprotected. It was pinned. The storm reached the gate and sent back a formal salute to Naomi before it passed through. Gillian Houston taking her ship back to Draper Station and waiting for new orders. That was a strange thought. Naomi had spent so much of her mental energy and focus on winning the battle, she'd almost forgotten about everything that came after. Freedom from Laconia couldn't mean a return to de facto rule by the Transport Union. For one thing, Medina Station was gone, and no one would be setting up a permanent base in the ring space again. For another, Laconia had replaced the structures of trade and control with its own. But still, there were ways. There wouldn't be a chokehold on the ring space the way there had been, but there could be a network of cheap, easily replaced relays that announced incoming and outgoing traffic. Ships could know, at least, what the chances were of going Dutchman before they made the transit. There weren't many people who'd choose to go through a ring gate if they knew they wouldn't come out the other side. Give the people enough information, and they'd be able to make the right decisions on their own. That was a problem for later, though. For the moment, she could watch the drive plumes of the ships that had broken Laconia touch the gate and escape, one after another, and think to herself, safe. 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 In the breaks between the hard burns, the crew celebrated and, unfortunately, fought. In the tension before the attack, Ian Kefilwe and another young man, an engineer named Safwan Cork, had fallen into bed together and were now negotiating the difficult romantic territory of having survived. She tried to keep out of it. But once she saw Jim sitting with Ian in one of the now empty torpedo bays, listening while the young man wept. It seemed right. The ship was only about 300,000 kilometers out from the ring gates, and the remaining burns were all breaking, making sure that when they did the transit, they had time on the far side to maneuver and not just slam into the other side of the sphere and vanish. The Laconian forces hadn't come after them, not even to throw more long-range torpedoes. Teresa Duarte was an astounding beast of a human being. Naomi tried to make a connection with her, but only once. They were in a pause, Alex making a gentle quarter G, and Naomi was getting dinner. It still felt strange to her, seeing the galley full. In her mind, there were still only 6 crew on the Rossi. Teresa was by herself, leaning against one of the walls, a bowl of noodles in one hand and chopsticks in the other. Her hair was braided back, and it made her face look harsher than usual. No one was sitting with her. No one was speaking to her, probably because no one knew what to say. Naomi served herself a bowl of white kibble and sat down across from the girl. Teresa looked up, and there was a flash of outrage before she reined herself in. "Is this okay?" Naomi asked. "It's your ship. You get to sit where you want. Gotta be a little strange being someplace like this, yeah?" Teresa nodded. Naomi took a bite of her kibble and wondered if they were going to sit in silence. Teresa shook her head. "There are people everywhere, and there's nowhere to go. Back home, I could be alone. No one's ever alone out here." "There are ways," Naomi said, thinking of her cargo container. "But there are usually fewer people here. It does get a little full. You should have a crew of 22. We usually may do with 6, sometimes 4. "I don't like it here," Teresa said, standing up. "I want to find someplace else once we leave." She walked away without saying anything else. She didn't put her uneaten bowl in the recycler. So when Naomi was finished with her own meal, she cleaned up after both of them, then walked down the corridor to her cabin. To theirs. Jim was in the crash couch. His jumpsuit was drenched in sweat at the armpits and down the back. He looked at her and shook his head. "I will never, ever get this out of shape again," he said. "This is miserable." "You'll get better," she said, and lay down beside him. The couch shifted to account for her added weight. Every time she saw him, she felt herself not quite trusting it, not quite letting herself believe he was really back, in case it was all a dream or a false reprieve, as if the universe would take him away from her again. It was getting better, but she wasn't sure it would ever completely go away. "I saw your friend in the galley," she said. "She's having some trouble adjusting, I think." "Well, she was the only child of a galactic god emperor, and now she's eating oatmeal in a half-antique gunship. That's got to be a hard transition." "What are we going to do with her once we get to the supply depot? You know she's too important to just let her go, right?" "I don't know that we can make her stay. Not unless we're talking about throwing her in a prison. But there are other options." "Are there?" "There were plenty of Martians who didn't take off with Duarte back in the day. Some of them will be cousins of hers. If we're lucky, some of them may be counselors and therapists. Or, I don't know, run rehabilitation centers. If not, if there aren't, some can be made. Everyone's related to everyone if you go back far enough. We'll just go back until the right people are connected to her." "You sound like Avasarala," Naomi said. "I've been thinking about her a lot. I feel like I built a little version of her in my head. You ever have that feeling?" "I know the one," Naomi said. And then, "Teresa doesn't just need a place to land and some sort of relatives. She needs love." "She had love. Her father loved her. He really did. What she didn't have was a sense of proportion. And then you brought her here." "She brought herself here," he said. "Just like we all do. and it's a pain in the ass for each and every one of us every time it happens. Outgrowing your family? Hard work under the best of circumstances, which these aren't. She lay down, snuggling into his arm. He was sweat damp, but she didn't care. She stroked her fingertips across his forehead and down his cheek. He turned his head, pressing into her hand like a cat that wanted petting. "Do you think she'll be okay?" Naomi asked. "No idea. She will or she won't. Either way, it's going to be up to her. I'm pretty sure she'll be herself while she does it, though. That's a victory for her. We'll help if we can. If she'll let us." The alert went on. Ring passage in 5 minutes. Jim sighed, stood, and started changing into fresh clothes. "What about you?" Naomi said. "What about me? Will you be okay?" Jim smiled, and there was only a little weariness in his eyes, only a little sorrow. "I played a long, terrible, shitty game, and I won. Then, after I won, I made it back home. I'm waking up in the morning next to you. I'm perfect." Chapter 50. Elvie. The day after Teresa escaped, Elvie spent the hours before dawn watching the feeds. As soon as the violence ended, even before the wounded and the dead were sorted, the stories began taking shape. The differences between the state news feeds and the security reports Elvie saw in the aftermath made it sound like there had been two different battles. The separatist terrorist forces, each of them tracked as they fled for the Ring Gate, had been driven back by the overwhelming power of the Laconian Navy. Or else, the enemy had achieved all its apparent objectives and withdrawn of its own accord. The orbital weapons platform network and land-based railguns had successfully protected Laconia from the enemy's last-ditch suicide attack. Or else the underlying assumption that the platforms and the base would be support for a naval defense had, in the heat of the moment, been ignored. And the enemy losses, while real, hadn't been catastrophic. The enemy was in flight, and the threats to Laconia required little more than a mopping up. Or else the whirlwind was going to be stuck close to the planet for the foreseeable future, while a handful of destroyers hunted down the stray torpedoes and rocks that had been launched at the planet, any one of which could cause massive damage. The most breathtaking lie, the one that put all the others to shame, was that the construction platforms had been taken down before the attack could reach them, and were being brought back to full operation in a secret location to protect them from further attack. The other stories about the battle might be extreme readings of the actual text, but the construction platforms were no more. There was no version of reality that supported the state's claims that they had survived. The former shipyards of Laconia were a collection of junk scattered in orbit around the planet, and no number of horses and men were going to put them together again. Added to that were all the things that the news feed simply didn't mention. That a fast attack frigate had landed within spitting distance of the state building. That the High Consul's daughter had run away with the enemy in what might perhaps be humanity's newest record-setting act of teenage rebellion. That the prisoner held in the state building had also escaped. Or that one prisoner had, anyway. "Major," the young man said. "Admiral Trejo is ready to see you." The lobby was a wide space with sandstone-colored columns and enough sofas and chairs to seat 100 people. She was the only one there. "Doctor," Elvie said. The young man looked confused. "I'm sorry?" "I'd prefer you call me Doctor. Major is an honorary rank. I earned my doctorate." "Yes, Dr. Okoye. Of course, the Admiral is ready to see me," she said, standing up and pulling her tunic straight. Lead the way. The meeting wasn't in one of the usual rooms. No formal desk, no volumetric display, no small crowd of men bowing to the power of the state and jockeying for their status in it. It was just her and Trejo in a private dining room. He had a simple breakfast of coffee and fruit with a sugar-iced pastry, and another like it set aside for her. A window almost as wide as the whole wall looked out over the snow-covered grounds and the land beyond all the way to the horizon. It felt a little obscene to think about the violence that had shaken it all. That they weren't both underground in a high-security shelter felt like another kind of lie. "Admiral," she said, sitting. The young man laughed immediately. Trejo poured her coffee himself.
"We found Illich," Trejo said instead of hello. "Well, his body, anyway. He and two of the State Guard were assassinated by the Separatists."
Elvi waited to feel something about that. The familiar, professionally thoughtful man she'd worked with was dead. She would never see him again. It wasn't the first time she'd lost a colleague. Back before anyone called her major, she'd taught at an upper university that had three of her fellow faculty members die in the same semester. She'd lost most of the science staff of the Falcon, and it had been devastating. This wasn't. Where the shock and sadness should have been, there was just an oceanic depth of resentment. She wasn't even perfectly clear whose name belonged on it. Duarte? Trejo? Holden? All of them together?
"Too bad," she said, because she felt like she ought to say something.
"He was loyal to the Empire," Trejo said. "Whatever his failings were, he was that."
She didn't know what she could say to that, so she didn't say anything.
"Our situation has once again changed," Trejo said, and paused to blow across the surface of his coffee.
He didn't just look exhausted. He looked 10 years older than when he'd arrived, and things had been broken beyond repair back then. Another few years like this, and Trejo would be the oldest man alive, no matter his age. She remembered a myth about someone wishing for eternal life, but forgetting to ask for youth to go with it. In the story, they'd gradually shrunk and withered until they turned into a cicada. She wondered if Faez knew who that story was about. She realized again that Trejo was waiting for her to respond. She didn't know what he wanted her to say, and didn't care much either.
"Are you feeling all right, Major?"
"Doctor," she said. "I think it would be best if you called me Doctor. And I'm fine. I've had a lot on my plate recently. I'm sure you understand."
"I do. I most certainly do," he said. "The construction platforms, the stick moons, they called them. They were what drew the High Council's attention to Laconia in the first place. Did you know that?" He saw them in the first wave of scans that came through when the gates opened. There was a vessel, something like a vessel, halfway built in one of them.
"I'd heard that," Elvi said. The coffee was good. The pastry was a little too sweet for her liking.
"They are the foundation of Laconian power."
Jesus Christ, Elvi thought. Had Trejo always been this sanctimonious and she just hadn't noticed? Or was she really just irritable right now?
"They stole a goal on us," he said. "I will give them that. They found a dirty trick and we fell for it.
Once. It won't happen again.
I need you to put aside the other issues you're looking into. For the time being. I know what you're going to say. Another first priority."
"That's where I would have started, yes," Elvi said.
"The loss of those platforms is the loss of the most powerful ships humanity has ever made. It's the loss of antimatter production. It's the loss of the regenerative tanks. Without them, we lose the ability to project our power out beyond the system.
Whether we're fighting against the terrorists or the things beyond the ring gates, we need that ability. So whatever the High Council has become gets shelved, she said. Figuring out the nature of the enemy and the weird system-wide attacks gets shelved. The secret of immortality? Shelved. I can hear your frustration, and I share it, Trejo said. But the fact remains, no, I'm good with that. But making more weapons isn't the first priority, she said. She took out her handheld, pulled up her notes, and passed it over. That right there? That is my first priority. Trejo scowled at the display, like she'd handed him some particularly unpleasant insect. Adro system? The big green diamond that looks like it might have a record of the entire protomolecule civilization, rise and fall. I would probably get the best results if the Falcon were repaired and crewed with a team specifically chosen for this project. I have some names drawn up. I'll send them to you. Dr. Okoye, I understand I'm not in a position to force you to do anything, but I'm comfortable in the belief that all of the issues we're trying to deal with are connected. And that, she pointed at the schematic of the massive diamond, looks more like the Rosetta Stone than anything else. So that's where I'm putting my efforts. In my professional judgment, it makes more sense than building bigger explosions or chasing after the Fountain of Youth. Trejo put down the hand terminal. His coffee sloshed over the lip of its cup, staining the white linen. We are in a war. Yes, you should fix that too. Excuse me? You should stop being in a war. Send the underground a fruit basket or something. Start peace talks, I don't know, however that works. I said it before and I meant it. If you want peace, lose gracefully. We have bigger problems. She took a last bite of the pastry and washed it down with the dregs of the coffee. It tasted better with the bitter following the sweet. Trejo was stone-faced. She stood. Do what you need to do, she said. I'm going to get ready for work, and then I'll be in the lab at the university. If you want to throw me in prison for insubordination or whatever the military term is, that's where you'll find me. If you want to fix this, let me know when the Falcon can be ready, and I'll brief you on everything I find. He didn't respond. She nodded curtly and walked away. She'd hoped she would feel better, and she did, but only a little. The wide sky of Laconia had cleared. The snow clouds were gone, and the air was crisp and bright, with just a hint of the spearmint smell of freshly turned Laconian earth. A flock or swarm of something flew high in the sky, vanishing against the sun and reappearing on its collective way to the south. Some organism following a temperature incline, or a nutrient gradient, or some other more exotic drive she didn't know about. That no one knew about. Not yet. They would, though, someday. If she could fix all this. Faez was awake when she got back to the rooms. He sat on the edge of their bed in the soft cotton pajamas that the Laconian Empire provided them gratis. He was massaging his new foot the way the physician had told him to. He looked up at her, worried. He hadn't slept since the night before, either. They'd gotten back to their rooms, cold and weary, and also in another kind of shock. She had been a pawn in Holden's chess game, and Holden had gotten her to the last rank and promoted her to a queen. Well, how's Trejo? Faez asked, mordant and hopeful. Are we exiled? No such luck, Elvis said. Maybe later. We could still leave. He was only partly joking. She imagined what it would be like, getting the Falcon back, or any ship, really. If they got off Laconia, they could go anywhere. Trejo wouldn't have the resources to chase them, not now. They could go back to Sol, or Baragam, or one of the new, struggling colonies. They could leave all this bullshit behind. Except that something out there was looking for a way to snuff out their minds, and there wasn't a better place to fight against that than right here. Her prison wasn't Laconia. Her jailer wasn't Trejo. The thing that had taken all her choices away was that this mystery so clearly needed to be solved, and she was so clearly the best one to do it. She kissed her husband softly and on the lips. When she pulled back, the humor was gone from his eyes. They'd been together for so long. They'd been so many different people together. She felt the change coming again. She was entering a new part of her life now. It meant packing away all her stories about how she was only here from fear of the authorities. The authorities were broken. She was here because she chose to be, and that changed everything. "I'm sorry," she said. "I know you were hoping for a gentlemanly retirement someplace that would give us both tenure."
"Or just one of us," he said. "I'm not greedy."
"We don't get to have that, and I'm sorry." Fires sighed, crossed his legs.
"If we don't, we don't."
"I still have you?"
"Always."
"Good enough," he said, and patted the mattress at his side.
"I have to go."
"Mixed signals," he said.
"I'll be back after work."
"You say that now, but I know you. You'll find something interesting and stay up until midnight chasing it, and by the time you come home, it'll be time to leave again."
"You're probably right."
"It's why everyone needs you," Fires said. "It's why I need you, too. When you get back, I'll be here."
"Thank you," she said.
"I'm sorry we couldn't run away together.
Maybe in our next lives."
The universe is always stranger than you think. It didn't matter how broad her imagination was, how cynical, how joyous and open, how well-researched or wild-minded. The universe was always stranger. Every dream, every imagining, however lavish and improbable, inevitably fell short of the truth. Elvie had been born in a system with a single star and a handful of planets. She'd studied exobiology when it was still theoretical. When she'd been a newly minted PhD, her greatest dream was that she might get a research fellowship on Mars, and maybe, the pinnacle of all her wildest hopes, find some hard evidence that life had evolved there independently. It would have been the most astounding, important thing she could imagine. She'd be in the scientific histories as the woman who discovered living structures that came from some place besides the Earth. Looking back, the dream seemed impossibly small. At the labs, she stopped to have a long talk with Dr. Ochida. She wanted a rundown of all the research being done, where it stood, who was heading up the projects, what his opinions were of the experimental designs. Even after Cortázar had died, she hadn't done that. Hadn't acted as though the labs were hers to run. Now she did, and Ochida didn't object. That probably made it true. At any rate, he answered everything she asked, and Trejo hadn't sent any guards to drag her away. So she was effectively in control of the most advanced research facility in the history of humankind, and if there was one thing that her decades in academic science had drilled into her consciousness, it was that power meant policy. "We're going to need to make some changes," she said. "We're shutting down the pen." Ochida actually stopped walking. She could have said that all the science teams were now required to walk on their hands, and the man would have been less astounded. "But the protomolecule, the supply..." "We have enough," she said. "Our reason for collecting more died with the construction platforms." "But the prisoners, What do we do with them? We're not executioners, Elvi said. We never should have been. When the guards come, tell them we don't accept the transfer. If Trejo wants to line people up against the wall and shoot them, I'm not in a position to stop that. But I can say we won't support it, and we won't base our research on it. From here on in, informed consent or work with East. Speed isn't the only measure of progress, Doctor, Elvi said. But she could tell from his eyes he didn't know what she meant. Just get it done, all right? Yes, Dr. Okoye, as you see fit. He almost bowed as he retreated. The universe is always stranger than you think. Elvi went to a private lab. There were so many things to do, so many possible pathways to follow in the research. She could keep the secret of Duarte's condition, or she could make her own research group, pulling from the best minds in Laconia. Trejo's conspiracy was down to just the two of them and Kelly, anyway, and with Teresa on the run with James fucking Holden, treating it as a state secret was more and more ridiculous. The chair seemed more comfortable now that it was hers. She knew it hadn't actually changed, but she had. She pulled up her waiting messages and ran through them. The most recent one was from the shipyards, giving her an unscheduled update on the status of the Falcon. She took it as an olive branch from Trejo. As she went through the list, she felt herself growing calmer, more focused. The complicated, obscure world of politics and intrigue fell away, and the complicated, obscure world of research protocols and alien biology took its place. It was like coming home. Fires had been right. She was going to be there until morning if she wasn't careful. But whatever she did, whatever path she took, the first step was the same. Even if it was a bad idea, it was necessary. The black-eyed children watched her as she went to their cage. Kara stood up, coming to meet her the way she often did. When Elvi undid the lock and slid the cage door open, Kara stared at it, confused. Her little brother walked to her side, slipped his smaller hand in hers. Elvi stood back, nodding to them. For the first time in decades, the two children stepped out of their cage freely. Zan's little chest was heaving in and out with the emotion of it. A tear slipped down Kara's grayish cheek.
Really?
Kara whispered. She meant, are we really free? There are some things I have to figure out, Elvi said, and her voice was trembling too. I hoped, if you're willing, that you would help me. Epilogue. Holden. Holden lay strapped in the autodock, his eyes closed. The ship was on the float, conserving the last of the reaction mass. He didn't mind. Weightlessness was a visceral reminder that he wasn't on Laconia anymore. He loved it for that. The machine ticked and hummed in a vaguely disapproving way, like it was trying to tell him to exercise more and cut back on salt. There were voices in the background. There were always voices in the background these days. After so many years with a skeleton crew, having a full complement felt like having a party where too many people had showed up and no one was leaving. A needle slid into his left arm, and the autodock chugged to itself, pumping in its own peculiar cocktail of oncocidals and anti-agathics and blood pressure stabilizers, and probably something for psychological distress. Lord knew he had that coming. The coolness gave him a pins and needles feeling on his lips, and he tasted something that his brain tried to interpret as peanuts. When it was done, The needle withdrew, and a thin scanning bar on an armature came out and waved a wand along his face. An image of his skull and lips appeared on the screen, with a new growth in green. "All the parts in the right place?" Naomi asked from the doorway. "Most of them," Holden said, and the scanner beeped at him, chiding. He stayed still while it finished. When the armature retracted, he said, "It does feel pretty fucking undignified to be teething at my age." "Well, they knocked your tooth out," Naomi said. Her tone was mild, but he could hear the murder behind it. He played it all down, but she knew. All the time he'd been under Laconian control, he'd made light of things. He'd made rules for himself so that his powerlessness didn't turn into despair. He'd plotted and planned and watched for opportunities. Now it was over, and everything he'd been careful not to feel was still waiting for him. "My dad used to say something when he'd been traveling," Holden said as the autodoc finished its run.
"Which one?"
"Father Caesar. He used to say that when you went too far, too fast, your soul took some time catching up to you." Naomi frowned. "I thought that was how religious fanatics argued that belters didn't have souls."
"Might have been that, too," Holden said.
"Father Caesar was talking about jet lag. Anyway, I was thinking about it with just change, you know?" He didn't talk about the day he'd been arrested much. Not with anyone besides Naomi. He'd been taken into custody on Medina Station, held for questioning. Not sure if he was going to live the rest of his life in a box or be slaughtered as a warning to others. And Governor Singh had shipped him back to Laconia for questioning about the aliens that had made the rings and the other aliens that had killed them. And through the first part of it, and then again on and off all the time he'd been gone, he'd had the sense that none of it was really happening. Or that it was, but not to him. He'd become someone else. Being a prisoner had driven him a little crazy for a while, and he still wasn't right. Not really. But every day he woke up on the Rossi with Naomi beside him, and Alex in the pilot's chair, he felt a little closer to sane. His soul a little bit nearer, in a wide and metaphorical sense. Naomi pushed off, floating to him, and catching herself with the unconscious grace of someone born to it. She took his hand. She did that a lot these days. He liked it, too, especially when he woke up in the middle of the night, too groggy from sleep to know where he was, and started to panic that the guards were coming to beat him again. Her voice calmed him down, but her hand in his worked faster. "We're going to start the braking burn in about 40 minutes, she said.
"Hard?"
"Alex says about 3/4 G. We'll be fine. But I thought I'd let you know anyway."
"We won't be trapped in the same couch for hours?"
"Well, not by that anyway," she said. He didn't know if the sly sexual banter was sincere or just another way of telling him he was home. It soothed him either way.
"Just between us," he said. "I'm going to be glad when it's just us again. These are nice folks, but they're not family, you know?"
"I do," she said. We might need to talk about hiring someone on, though. With Clarissa and Bobby both gone."
"Yeah," he said. "We'll look at it."
He meant, "But not now. Later. When I can." She heard it all.
"I'm going to go check the coolant feed lines," she said. "These kids all grew up on newer ships. They're not used to our heat tolerances."
"All right," Holden said. "I'm going to finish this and head for the flight deck."
"Sounds good," she said, and pushed backward, keeping her eyes on him as she moved away to the door and caught herself without even looking. After she was gone, the autodoc chimed, giving him permission to unstrap himself. He moved slowly, not because he hurt, but because he liked the sensation of freeing himself. The report was on the screen when he got there. All in all, it was pretty solid. He pulled up a record going back to his return.